travel through our state. And remember, slow, steady, safe for the long haul. I'll see you on the road.
We are right now with the systemic issues with policing. What people are really seeking is the opportunity to air their grievances, to see systemic problems fixed, and the opportunity to engage with public safety leaders directly, which the board represents. Citizen Oversight Board has three main responsibilities. The first is the oversight of the Office of the Independent Monitor, which includes hiring and firing the monitor themselves and making sure that that person is really leading a high-performance organization. The second is making policy recommendations and other recommendations regarding the public safety environment, and even in the case of specific incidents. And the third thing is addressing community complaints. Any community member could bring an experience they've had or a challenge that they've had, a concern that they see to the board. It's a 9-member board that is intended to be broadly representative of the city itself. Board members are passionate, committed, and really invested in seeing change.
Independent Audit Committee was established by charter and receives audit reports and other information from the Denver Audit Office. The committee strives to bring greater clarity, transparency, and accountability to Denver's city government and its residents. It is also responsible for commissioning an annual audit of the city's annual comprehensive financial report. This committee is chaired by Auditor Timothy M. O'Brien.
October 17th meeting of the Independent Audit Committee to order. Amy?
Jack Blumenthal?
Here.
Lorraine Nass?
Here.
Leslie Mitchell?
Here.
Greg Rowe?
Here.
And O'Brien?
Here. All right, we have a quorum. Next item is approval of the August minutes and the September minutes. I think we could do that in one motion. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of the last two meetings?
So moved.
And we need a second.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Audit briefing on fleet management. Patrick, do you want to introduce yourself and the audit team? And then I'll ask the department to introduce themselves. And if you have any opening comments, that would be a good time.
Sure, great. Pat Schaefer, the senior manager. This is the team. I'll turn it over to Jennifer in a second to introduce the team that actually did the audit work. Just real quick, I wanted to talk about why this report is important, right? These 13 recs on how the city can improve management of the fleet. There's four things that come to mind. Service delivery, right? The fleet enables city agencies to provide essential services. One that comes to mind that relies on the fleet is solid waste, right? So essential services. Number two, efficiency. A well-managed fleet ensures services are delivered promptly without delay, disruptions, things like that. The third reason, cost effectiveness. You know, managing the fleet a little bit better, it equates to a better deployment of tax dollars. And the last one, number four, community well-being. Managing the fleet better increases the likelihood that city operations are going to run a little smoother. And when that happens, there's a direct impact on community well-being. So those are all good reasons why this report is important. So enough from me. I'll turn it over to Jennifer, and she can introduce the team.
Awesome. Morning, everyone. Jennifer Lim, audit manager, and joining me today is the audit team. To my left, we have senior auditor Jackson Rossmith, lead auditor Simon Achille, and Sean Jones, senior auditor. There are also two others who contributed to this report who couldn't be here today. That's former audit manager Vilma Balnate and lead auditor Katie Casalino.
The department?
Sure. I'll introduce myself. I'm Cindy Patton. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. I've been with the city for 15 years in different capacities, but all within Public Works in the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure.
Brad Salazar, so I'm the Dottie Fleet Director. I've been with the City and County Public Works for 24 years.
And I'm Peter Spanberger. I'm the Director of Accounting for Dottie. I've been with the City for 13 years.
All right. Any opening comments, or should we just dive right in?
I'll just say, just to put us off on a really great foot, we have been really thankful to work with this team. I feel like I've been through a number of audits at the city in my 15 years, and this has been truly more like a partnership. And from the very beginning, working together on uncovering things and being very thoughtful about the findings and then our responses to the findings. So I'm excited for you to see the details.
Thank you.
And on that same note, just wanted to share our appreciation to you all as well. I think everyone has been really timely and thorough in their responses, and it's been great to just step inside your world of fleet management. So thank you all.
All right, let's get started.
Awesome. So our audit objectives were to determine whether the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure's Fleet Management Division was adequately managing and overseeing the city's fleet. This included an evaluation of the city's funding structure, determining whether the city met its fleet-related targets, and reviewing systems and procedures used to protect fleet assets. Our scope covered January 2022 through March 2024. So starting with the background on page one, the Fleet Management Division of the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure oversees and manages over 2,500 vehicles and equipment across 43 city departments and agencies. Fleet management does not manage fleet for the police, fire, or the airport. These are administered separately, and for this reason, we excluded them from our audit scope. The department and agencies operate and safeguard their own vehicles, but the Fleet Management Division manages every other aspect of the city's fleet. This includes for things like repairs, maintenance, and fueling. The city funds its fleet-related expenditures using either the general fund or the planned vehicle replacement fund. So the general fund covers costs for things like fuel, maintenance, repairs, personnel, and facilities. The fleet management's general fund budget was $16 million in 2022 and $22 million in 2023. The other fund, the planned vehicle replacement fund, is used to purchase new vehicles. This fund had a budget of $2 million in 2022 and $5 million in 2023. Fleet management uses three information systems in its operations, the first one being AssetWorks. This is the main database used to support the end-to-end fleet management process. Then there's FuelForce, which is used to control fuel access and fuel transactions. And lastly, Samsara Networks, which is a telematic system that uses a device installed in city-owned vehicles to track things like location, record patterns, and diagnose the health of each vehicle. So throughout the presentation, you'll hear the team reference the Mercury audit. A couple of years back, fleet management requested an audit to identify weak points in their operations. And so they used Mercury Associates, a consulting firm specializing in fleet management services, to perform that audit. And that audit was completed in 2023. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions on the background, if there are any. So then with that, I'll just pass it over to Jackson to cover finding one, as well as some of finding two.
Thank you, Jennifer. Finding one, beginning on page four of the report, states the current fleet funding structure results in transportation and infrastructure paying for other agencies' fuel and maintenance costs. The city currently funds its vehicle fleet operations using a general fund model, where transportation and infrastructure pays for the bulk of other agencies' fuel and maintenance costs, with the notable exceptions being Denver Police, Denver Fire, and the Denver International Airport. One alternative to using a general fund is an internal service fund approach, where agencies are charged back for the fuel and maintenance costs they incur. This approach was the city's practice before 2015, until the city changed to the general fund model. However, the city ordinance still currently reflects that an internal service fund be used to support fleet operations. To understand that the city is currently using the best approach to fund its fleet operations, we reviewed the financial statements of and sent out surveys to 17 cities and counties to identify how they are currently funding their fleets. These surveys showed all but three of the 17 are currently funding their fleets using an internal service fund. The fundamental benefits of using an internal service fund over a general fund are increased accountability and financial sustainability, resilience to adverse economic conditions, and its alignment with industry-leading practices. These benefits are supported by the surveys we conducted, as well as consulting with a fleet management expert who said the City and County of Denver should be using an internal service fund. Therefore, we make the following recommendation. Recommendation 1.1 on page 6 of the report states the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure should work with the Department of Finance to evaluate and document whether adopting an internal service fund approach is in the best financial and operational interests of the city. After the evaluation, Transportation and Infrastructure and Finance should update the city ordinance and formalize procedures to match the funding structure selected. The department agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of December 31st, 2025. I would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the department or the committee members.
Comments from the department?
I think we're in agreement with the recommendation. We want to evaluate and see what the best course of action would be moving forward. I think fundamentally it's a funding challenge. So we want to be mindful of the fact that currently, if we do, we are not fully funded to address all the needs given the age of the fleet. If we were to pass that along to our brother and sister agencies across the city, they also would need to have the additional funding in order to pay for those things. So we don't want to pass the problem along, and we want to make sure that people, though, also are utilizing the fleet and understand the value of the repairs, the costs associated with utilizing their fleet. Right now, that's buried in the general fund. Mm-hmm. So that's not necessarily understood. If something needs to be fixed, you just send it away to the magic agency, it gets fixed, gets sent back to us. So I think that there would be a lot of benefit in that. There's probably a few hybrid approaches between where we are today and a full internal service fund that we could evaluate. So we definitely want to work closely with the Department of Finance and evaluate what's the best for Denver at this moment.
Lauren?
Was there any was there any documentation as to why the model changed in 2015? It was the way you're recommending before 2015, right?
2014. Yeah.
So why did the city change in 2015?
When you spoke with the Department of Finance, because it was about 10 years ago, there's not a paper trail, but we were told that there was it was administratively burdensome to manage the fleet in an ISF fund, internal service fund, sorry.
Do you have any recollection? I mean, you've been around for a long time.
Yeah, and unfortunately, none of us were really close to the decision-making at the time, but that's similar to what we've heard, that administratively, I think there were some grumblings around how it was being managed. The systems that were managing that, the transparency behind the management of it, and I think as budgets got tighter, that became more of a challenge, you know, as many things do. So it was working fine, and then as dollars had to stretch further, there was more fighting over whether or not those repairs were at the value they were being charged and so forth. And so I think eventually the Department of Finance felt like it was more trouble than it was worth.
Well, I was going to ask any insight into why the ordinance wasn't changed also, because it still says you have an internal service fund.
We do have some internal service funds currently with Enterprise. So if you're an Enterprise fund, this is really anything that's on the general fund, through the general fund.
So, yeah, what I was going to say, I think also with an internal service fund, you know, it operates like an enterprise fund in that the fees charged have to recover the full cost of providing service. And by doing that, to Cindy's point, it really put more of a burden on all the other departments. And I think that was part of the reason that DOF wanted to go back into the general fund, where there's just more flexibility with that. And then the second question what was the second point you just made there?
The ordinance.
Yeah, the ordinance change. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question as far as DOF. Yeah. I'm not sure why that was
changed.
But what I was going to say is Fleet does still charge enterprise funds and some non-city agencies. General fund funds, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it is sort of...
Expenses shouldn't change, right?
The charge is the same.
Right. If you need tires on a truck, it costs X amount of dollars. It's whether you guys are paying for it or the actual agency that uses it pays. And then we have to decide... Is it worth the additional cost of you trying to allocate those expenses versus you just taking them out of your own funds? Am I really simplistically getting down to it?
And it is pretty simple. There's the repair costs.
Right.
There are the fuel costs. Right. There's parts costs that are separate from the labor. And then there's obviously the cost for replacement over time. And so all of those things are kind of managed differently today.
And so historically, though, the fees that we charge, I mean, it doesn't cover vehicle replacements, correct?
Correct.
I mean,
yeah,
so
it's
really
just
operational maintenance. So if we're going to do an internal service fund, I mean, we should also look at having our rates cover vehicle replacement costs as well.
Essentially, facilities costs.
Yeah, facilities costs. There's a lot to it if you want to run it as a proper enterprise, as an internal service fund. And I think that's where DOF gets nervous, because those costs would get passed on to parks and, you know, all those other departments who are already stretched from a budget perspective.
But who use it, the services?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, I think digging into what the labor rates as well. So, you know, what would those labor rates look like in comparison to you know, other governments, other entities, in relation to on the outside, right? So we could still be cost efficient. So.
And that's some of the work we did with the Mercury audit, and thank you for mentioning that. We wanted to work with an outside consultant, and we handed that report over from beginning to end to this team to review. Instead of just sending over pieces, we really wanted to be open book. So that is one thing that we need to do, is evaluate the charges that we are, not only if we consider moving some of those general funds into an internal service fund, but even the folks that are currently enterprise, are we using the right charges to make sure that we're sustainable and we can offer good service and reliable service? Because it is the heart of what we provide to the citizens of Denver, trucks.
One question on fueling is, you know, the city is moving towards electrification, which probably is going to impact the fleet, change in fuel. Is it going to be harder to track versus the Parks Department plugging it in versus stopping at the fuel depot? Do you have all that figured out?
Well, I wouldn't say we have it all figured out. But we do have some really talented staff who are tracking that today. So I would call up Bill Zolo, who's sitting in the audience. He's with one of our managers on the fleet team. And so we currently do have dashboards that track the both fuel usage and electricity usage for the EVs that we have. But I think one really nice thing about this audit is that a lot of the recommendations relate to one another. So one thing that we think is also really important that I think Jackson will probably get into is the utilization of the overall fleet. Are we utilizing our fleet well? Do we need to better right-size our fleet? And if there was a right-sizing of the fleet to really make sure that we're meeting needs, but we don't have assets that are underutilized but still costing the city money, do we make up some ground there? With some of our charges.
I think it also works with our green fleet and our sustainability team. So working with CASAR, as we use less fuel, obviously will increase electricity, and then funding for either of those. Do they alternate? Do they switch? Do you move them back and forth? Things of that nature. So working with our CASAR team to get a lot of that information and data from the chargers that are being installed citywide.
We have a great partnership with them and an entire green fleet committee that's made up of multiple agencies that are currently meeting right now.
Yeah, I noticed riding my bike around Denver that a lot of the trash trucks seem to have been leased in the last couple of years as opposed to new. And to your point, you know, it kind of struck me that somebody was playing some accounting games. In other words, they didn't maintain the fleet, they didn't fund the depreciation. And then all of a sudden, they felt the need to lease, which is not necessarily the best way to do it. What's your take on it? And is this whole accounting issue, did that contribute to this situation?
There's a lot of contributing factors. It's been a complicated web over the last few years, including supply chain delays with delivery of vehicles, that kind of thing, that have exacerbated especially the state of our refuse trucks and fleet. But I would say for the trash trucks in particular, we want to separate two things. There's the operational day-to-day costs, and then there's the fleet replacement fund. And right now, when we talk about the internal service fund, like Peter was saying, that's just covering the cost of day-to-day repairs, your fuel that you use every year. Then there's the choices that the city has made in investing in its replacement fund. That I think we'll cover in a future recommendation here, so we may table that for a response then. But those both have been underfunded to keep the city's fleet with up to the availability level that we think is industry standard. And that's what the findings have shown, is that we would like to be at a 95% availability rate, and we're under that right now. So that's what you're seeing, is we are trying to still be out there delivering the service and be creative in the ways that we're doing that. So you're seeing some different partnerships in order for us to do that.
Yeah, but here's my question on that. Is this really a bunch of budgeting gimmicks? In other words, I'm not blaming you guys for that. But, you know, when somebody isn't funding the depreciation and taking care of the equipment, you know, everything looks good, you know, for a few years, and then all of a sudden something else is happening. And so, and you're shaking your head, yes. And I guess the question that I've got, we have a new mayor, but it sounds to me like there were some financing / budgeting gimmicks that were employed in prior years. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the supply chain, I can't buy that, because if the company leasing the trucks was able to get the trucks, mm-hmm. the city could have ordered the trucks. I don't know.
And if
you think I'm all wet, I'm certainly, I'm certainly open to that.
I don't know that I would go so far as to say budgeting gimmicks. I do think that there have been some really hard choices that the city's had to make, especially in the COVID years, to dramatically pull back the replacement dollars. And we're seeing some of the impacts of those choices. I don't think that they were malicious in any way. It's been a lot of needs and a lot of peanut butter to spread across the different agencies of the city. And that was one that took a hit. And so because of that, the city's been trying to be very mindful about how to make our dollar stretch. And capital lease has been one of those mechanisms to be able to get trucks on the ground and eventually own them, but lease them to own over time. And then we're also partnering with some outsourced vendors that are also providing some trucks right now, especially in the solid waste space.
Well, you say it very nicely.
Thank you. I'm trying.
So I think we're getting ahead of where we are on the report in terms of utilization and the fleet and things like that. Why don't we continue with the report and we can ask more questions at that point in time?
No, I think we're fine.
Okay. Sorry. Jackson?
Thank you. I will now present the first sub-finding of Finding 2. Finding 2, beginning on page 7 of the report, states the city is not meeting its targets for vehicle use, availability, and fleet replacement. Finding 2 centers around the reality that inefficiencies in fleet management can delay and disrupt city services, making it critical for the city to achieve its fleet use, replacement, and availability objectives, which are all interrelated. The crux of the underlying issues identified in Finding 2 is that transportation infrastructure lacks the authority to effectively manage and therefore optimize the city's fleet in a meaningful way. We have broken these issues down into three sub-findings covering underused vehicles, replacement of vehicles, and vehicle availability. Sub-finding 1, beginning on the same page of the report, states the city's fleet is underused. To better understand the current use rate of city vehicles, we evaluated the division's own internal monitoring of vehicle use data, conducted our own analysis on vehicle use data, and reviewed the report from outside fleet management consulting firm, Mercury Associates. We found the city's fleet is underused by 22 to 43%, with overall results being consistent across the three evaluations. The variance in use rate can be attributed to there being multiple different ways to calculate use, including numbers of trips taken, hours driven, or miles driven in a month. Mercury Associates concluded that underused assets cost the city $5.7 million in maintenance and repair costs from 2022 through 2023. It's important to keep in mind that the city's fleet includes light-duty and heavy-duty vehicles. Heavy-duty vehicles are of a more specialized nature and require different standards for calculating use, as well as sometimes needing additional training and licensing to operate. However, light-duty vehicles are more easily repurposed or shared between departments. Additionally, we found some agencies experience peaks and valleys in vehicle demand throughout the year. For example, snowplows are in higher demand in winter months. However, seasonality appears to be low when looking at the overall use rate across the fleet. Having some difficulty here. I'm pushing the button, yes. The button isn't working. Because of the size and complexity of the city's fleet, identifying one core reason for why the fleet is where it's at and how it's gotten where it's at today would be challenging. However, some key contributing factors are the lack of authority to right-size the fleet, agencies being potentially reluctant to relinquish control of vehicles they currently have, and the fleet still being the size of to support pre-pandemic operations. The reality is that underused vehicles continue to amass costs that take up resources even when they're not being used, such as operational fees, preventive maintenance, and the cost of fuel that will eventually spoil if not used. In addition to the challenges of finding parking for unused vehicles and agencies facing ongoing budget constraints, a city fleet that sits unused will not see its full potential and will both directly and indirectly waste taxpayer resources. Therefore, we make the following two recommendations. I'll read both recommendations before pausing for questions and comments. Recommendation 2.1 on page 10 of the report states the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure should work with the mayor's office to get operational authority to help manage the city's fleet more effectively. This could take the form of establishing agreements and a formal process for objectively evaluating the use of city vehicles. The department agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of December 31st, 2025. Recommendation 2.2 on the same page of the report states depending on the implementation and results of recommendation 2.1, the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure should develop and document a formal process to evaluate vehicle usage. The results of this should be used to work with other city agencies to improve vehicle use so that it is in line with available to achieve the desired vehicle use rate. The department agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of December 31st, 2025. I'd like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the department and audit committee members.
Audit committee? You know, it seems to me like on the utilization. Say we have a department or an agency that has four vehicles that have a 50% utilization. So logically, you could get rid of two. Certainly, you could get rid of one. But there doesn't seem to be an incentive for the agency to get rid of any of them. And that's why I think the report goes the direction it does, because it would give you more control, it would give the department more control over the assets. And if an agency wants to have an excess vehicle, they simply have to pay for it. Right now they don't.
There's certainly someone needs to be the arbiter of this. I think right now we like to think of ourselves as a matchmaker. So if someone is in need, and we did this a lot during COVID, we have a list of where all the fleet vehicles are assigned to, what agencies have them. We can call up an agency who might have that particular vehicle and say, would you mind sharing this vehicle for this time? And we can kind of make those connections, but we have no authority. In that case, sometimes the EOC had the authority, but we did not have the authority to then say, well, you're underutilizing it, so I'm now going to put it in its highest and best use over here. And that is something that I think has stymied us. There's also the thought of a motor pool, and we do have a city motor pool right now that can be used for if you just need to get from A to B, and that's an irregular use, or you just need it for an hour, you can check out a vehicle. But right now there's just a cultural cultural environment of having your own and using that and having the keys in your drawer, right? Mm-hmm. So you can run out and use that whenever you want. And I'm not sure we're in the financial environment to have that luxury in all cases. But to the point of the heavy duty equipment, that's very different, right? I have an auger truck that I need to drill a case on, and that's probably not going to be what the library needs. So in those cases, we have to be judicious, but at the end of the day, I think matchmaking is not getting us as far as we need to go with making sure our fleet is right-sized, and therefore our investments in that fleet are right-sized.
And your implementation dates are pretty far out. Is there a reason for that?
Well, we don't have the authority to make these decisions. So it'll take a lot of collaboration with both the Department of Finance and the Mayor's Office, build some champions and see how far we can get.
And that's all within a very tight budget.
within a tight budget,
right.
And within potentially, you know, the 2026 budget conversations.
For sure. Right.
But this report should help.
Yes, and thank you.
And I think there's some constraints too, whether they're general fund or non-general fund. So whether general fund purchased the vehicles or the agency themselves purchased the vehicles, and then the transfer of those assets. So there's additional rules around transferring of assets, depending on how they were funded and purchased as well. So on the utilization side, another side of that is understanding the operational use of each type of vehicle. So just because it's in our system as a truck, it may have a utility body, a lift gate, a crane on it or something, where the majority of people just say, oh, you have this truck in your fleet, can we use this because we need a truck, not understanding the operational use or the specs of how that vehicle's set up.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Shall we continue?
Thank you. Simon will now present the second sub-finding of finding two.
All right, thank you, Jackson. So finding 2.2, beginning on page 11 of the report, says the city is not meeting its goal of replacing vehicles as they reach the end of their useful life. Vehicles in the city typically have a 10-year useful life, and fleet management have set a goal to replace 10% of the fleet annually to prevent vehicles from exceeding that useful life. However, actual replacements for the past 2 years fell short of this goal, with 3.8% of the fleet replaced in 2022 and 4.7% in 2023. Because of this shortfall, close to 36% of the fleet is currently beyond its useful life. Part of the reason, as mentioned in the previous section, is that the fleet is too large for the usage shown in the data. The available funding is also not enough to keep up with the number of vehicles that are aging out. Replacing vehicles as they reach the end of their useful lives is a critical part of managing the city's fleet, as these vehicles have longer and more frequent downtimes, higher maintenance and repair costs, and when they are retired, the resale value is lower. Vehicles that are both underused and beyond their useful life therefore represent an avoidable burden on fleet resources. Recommendation 2.3 on page 13 is for the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure to work with city agencies to identify and document a plan for vehicles that are approaching the end of their useful lives and determine the best course of action for each. If funding is not available to replace a vehicle, the department should document an alternative plan. Implementing this recommendation may be assisted by the additional authority obtained from implementing recommendation 2.1. The department agreed with the recommendation with a goal implementation date of July 1st, 2025. We'll break here for any comments or questions on finding 2.2.
Any questions from the committee? Comments from the department?
I'll just highlight in our response here, we do have a process to guide replacements every year. We are still learning a brand new system with AssetWorks, so that's being done a little bit differently than it has in years past with our previous system, Faster. But it's all points-based, so it looks at the age of the vehicle and the investments and repairs that we've made in that vehicle and calculates based on those things which vehicles are eligible for replacement. And then we make those recommendations to each department that we serve, our customers, so that they can help inform and tell us, you know, well, this vehicle may have lower mileage, for example, but isn't operational and we need it for these specific reasons. So we do start out very data-driven, and then that moves into a conversation with the customers, and then it's very constrained by what budget is actually available.
Okay. Simon?
I'll move on to recommendation 2, subfinding 3, which begins on page 14 and states that the city missed vehicle availability goals impacting the delivery of public services. One of fleet management's key performance indicators is availability. Availability refers to the percent of vehicles not down for maintenance or repairs, meaning a vehicle may be in use but would still be included in the number of available units. The division has set a goal of 95% availability for the agencies it serves. This goal aligns with guidance from the National Association of Fleet Administrators. Figure 4 on page 14 shows that during the period covered under our audit, availability was between 90 and 94%, with a downward trend from 2022 to 2023. A lasting decline in the availability of city vehicles can have consequences on agencies and the services they provide. sanitation, environmental and utilities services, among others, cannot provide essential public services if critical vehicles are not available when needed. When researching the causes of low availability, management pointed to the lack of staffing. There were not enough maintenance technicians available to perform the work needed to keep up with repairs and maintenance for city vehicles. As outlined in Figure 5 on page 14, an estimate from the Mercury audit was that the division would need 76 full-time equivalent technicians to keep up with the demand for repairs and maintenance at the fleet's current size and age. The division was budgeted for 64 technicians in 2023 and 70 in 2024. However, fleet management staff said they have faced difficulties filling these positions and retaining fleet technicians because they compete for hires with private companies that can offer better compensation. To help address these issues, division managers said they have started including incentives such as hiring bonuses when posting job openings. To keep up with the demand for repairs and maintenance, the division leaned more on outsourcing, which we'll discuss more later. The division also approved employee overtime for snow support, waste management, and emergencies to make sure that agencies who had an urgent need for their vehicles had access to them. Therefore, we make the following two recommendations. I will read both recommendations before pausing for questions and comments. Recommendation 2.4 on page 16 states the Fleet Management Division should develop and document a plan to meet availability goals. The plan should consider right-sizing the fleet, as described in Recommendation 2.3, to ensure agencies have access to vehicles at least 95% of the time. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of March 31st, 2025. And Recommendation 2.5 on the same page states the Fleet Management Division should develop and document a plan to address its staffing needs annually. The plan should include alternative staffing solutions to meet availability goals given the challenges around filling vacancies. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of July 1st, 2025. So I'd like to open up the floor for any questions or comments from the department or audit committee members.
Questions from the committee? I have a question about the staffing, the competitiveness. The Office of Human Resources does competitive analyses for departments. Have you engaged them?
Yeah, and we've done a number of salary adjustments over the past couple of years. And I would say the staffing conversation is a complicated one. Over the past, you know, since COVID, we've experienced staffing challenges due to different pressures. In the beginning, it was because we were having a really hard time attracting staff. That is not let off the gas entirely. That is still a challenge. But some of the adjustments that we've done with partnership in the OHR have really helped that. And in our most recent recruitments, we have had interesting parties who are qualified, and we have made offers. In the more recent past, it's been we don't have the budget to hire because we are spending so much of Dottie's budget, and this was one of the original points, on our outsourced dollars, on fuel, on the operational needs of the fleet program, that we're digging into our vacancy savings in order to do that. So we don't have the bandwidth to actually hire. So that's been the pressure. And in both cases, it keeps those technician counts low. And when you look, you know, we're not wholly far off from what the Mercury recommendation is. We need about 10 more techs, but we are nowhere near our fill rate of allocated positions we have today. And so that's really my next benchmark, is can we get closer to what I actually could hire in our allocated number of positions? And then we'll work towards growing those number of positions.
Okay. Thank you.
So I have a question, and this is so far outside of what I know and understand. But if the reason, one of the reasons, and I get it's a tough market to hire, but if one of the reasons is that you don't have the budget because you're spending money on maintenance, outsourcing maintenance, is that outsourcing of maintenance more expensive? So that if you, it's kind of a catch-22.
100%.
If you could hire more people, then you wouldn't outsource so much and you wouldn't be, am I understanding that? Is that?
Yes, and there are things that we don't have the capability to do in-house. There are just transmission repairs, windshields. There are things that we are not full service. We are close.
So you have to outsource some stuff.
Uh-huh. But our outsource spending did balloon over the last few years, and a lot of that is related to the aging fleet.
And this is not specific to you, but it's just a curiosity question. In the inability to hire qualified technicians. Is that because they don't exist? Which is a whole different issue. That it's just an issue that I think we have, my opinion is, we have as a country, that we really need to be in, you know, we need more workforce development, but that's a different story. Or is it because there's the competitive nature, and I realize those two things go hand in hand.
I think a little bit of both. So competitive nature on what the outside can offer versus what we can offer as far as starting points for seasoned technicians, for sure, on the more experienced side. And then just the industry in itself, right? So nationwide, there's a shortage of fleet techs. Nationwide, as people transition to other jobs or other careers, a lot of people don't want to be technicians. You know, they don't want to work smooth shifts, graveyards, whatever it takes in fleets to keep fleets operational. So there's a mixture of both there for sure.
Thank you.
All right, shall we continue?
I will now present finding 3 in the first sub-finding. Finding 3, beginning on page 18, is that inadequate controls create the risks of waste and abuse. This section contains 3 sub-findings. Sub-finding 1 is that fuel access is not properly managed or monitored, risking inappropriate fuel transactions. The city operates 6 fueling sites throughout the city. During the scope of our audit, these sites dispensed $4.4 million and $4.6 million worth of fuel in 2022 and 2023, respectively. Figure 7 on page 19 details the fuel approval process. In short, an employee must enter an assigned user ID, the vehicle number, and the vehicle's odometer reading in order to access fuel at one of the city's fueling sites. The odometer reading is used to track vehicle activity, but also ensures that someone without access to a vehicle can also not access fuel. Details of the transaction are recorded in FuelForce and uploaded into AssetWorks daily. The fuel administrator reviews transaction records every month to identify unusual usage and follows up with drivers, their supervisors, or agencies as necessary. We identified several issues along this process. First, there is a lack of secondary review of the driver list. A single fuel administrator is responsible for adding and removing drivers' fuel access and is also responsible for the accuracy of the driver and transaction lists. Without an independent review, unauthorized additions could remain in the system undetected. Second, fleet management staff are often not notified by user agencies when drivers leave city employment so that their fuel access can be removed. The division's internal policies and procedures state that the authorized driver list should be audited quarterly, but we found that these had not been performed. We compared an authorized driver listing against the city's active employee roster for the same date and were unable to match 1,782 drivers, or 25% of the driver list. To confirm our findings, we took a sample of these unmatched drivers and found that all but one of the drivers in our sample were no longer with the city. We also found 104 transactions totaling about $3,500 that used ID numbers from drivers no longer employed by the city at that time. For each of those 9 drivers, we followed up with the agencies that had employed them. When we received a response, the finding was due to multiple employees sharing a single user ID. For 6 of the 9 drivers, however, we cannot determine the cause as we did not receive a response from the relevant agencies. We also looked at the use of override codes. In the event of after-hours needs or emergencies, fleet management supervisors can give drivers an override code that allows fueling without a vehicle's odometer information. Although policy states that the codes are to be used one time only, these codes don't expire. We learned of one employee who was granted permission to use an override code for a single transaction, who then continued to use that code for 5 months. When using override codes, drivers are required to send an email with details of the transaction to a shared inbox monitored by division administrators. As part of the monthly review, the fuel administrator overwrites the record to replace the override details with those from the email. Given the risky nature of override transactions, a record should be preserved to confirm the validity of those transactions, as well as to assess trends in override use to inform operational improvements. We have 2 recommendations given on page 21 of the report. Recommendation 3.1 states that the Fleet Management Division should create a comprehensive fueling policy that addresses user access, transaction review procedures, appropriate use of override codes, preserving override transaction history, and training to ensure that users understand and follow the policy. Recommendation 3.2 is that the Fleet Management Division should remove all former city employees from its authorized driver list and develop, implement, and document procedures to keep the list promptly and consistently accurate. I'll pause here for any questions or comments on subfinding 3.1.
Any questions or comments from the committee, from the department?
Yeah, we're excited about this because we have just received word that iFund is funding a replacement of this system, and a lot of the challenges that were noted here are as a result of a really antiquated software system. So this will help us to update our current standard operating procedure that addresses a lot of these things, but do it with a new system that'll have more foolproof measures. And we did laugh a lot about this one because, you know, there's 7,000 transactions per month. So for example, we should never have an unauthorized user use the system, right? But we are talking about a 0.1% occurrence, but that should, even that number should dramatically go down. And some of the other controls that are lacking today, I think, should be addressed by the system. So we're really excited about that investment that's been promised.
And I think I would just like to note that we actually have a policy process in place. It's just going to be updating that current process and policy to cover the loopholes that were found during the audit. So we're recognizing there were loopholes, there were some instances where things did fall through. It's just updating, creating our new policy, which we'll end up having to do with the use of a new system as well. So
yep.
As we implement that new system, we'll implement and update all of those SOPs and policies with it.
So we have a much better user experience.
How will that apply to the EVs?
That's a good question. I don't think at this point Fuel Force covers.
Fuel Force doesn't cover EVs, but with the chargers or the charging infrastructure, as they're plugged into vehicles, there are, they're web-based, so you can get dashboards to those vendors. So whether we're using ChargePoint or an alternate vendor, there's access to those dashboards that actually tell you the kilowatt usage and the state of charge on those vehicles, as well as our telematic system. So using our telematic system, we get a lot of that information as they're tied straight into the ECMs. So
we can
monitor some of that now.
And they are issued a barcode that they use at the charging stations.
Yeah, they have cards. So when they go plug into an electric charger, they have to scan the card, which actually turns on and activates the charger. So it's specific to each vehicle by VIN.
Thank you. Simon?
All right, thank you. With that, I'll turn it over to Sean to present the second finding of the second subfinding of finding three.
Thank you, Simon. Subfinding 2, beginning on page 22 of the report, states parts storage may be accessed by unauthorized parties and parts are not always tracked to jobs. The Department of Transportation and Infrastructure and its divisions, Procurement and Logistics and Fleet Management, are tasked with repairing and maintaining a city fleet of around 1,400 vehicles that all experience general wear and tear differently. To achieve this, the department keeps various critical items and parts readily available in stock rooms throughout the city. The Procurement and Logistics and Fleet Management divisions share parts management responsibility. Both divisions work together to ensure parts are stored securely and are accounted for during all levels of the distribution and parts use. However, we found weaknesses in the overall physical access to these critical parts that increases the risk of theft and misuse. For example, there are currently an unknown number of keys in circulation for stock rooms and unrestricted access to tires and other fleet materials. In 2018, the two divisions agreed that to encourage accountability for parts, performance evaluations for staff members assigned to stock rooms should include ensuring that parts checkout procedures are followed and that all parts are properly allocated to work orders. This process was codified in a service level agreement, and to date, the division has not yet implemented this process. Under this service level agreement, there are two ways fleet management staff can access parts. The first way involves fleet management requesting vehicle parts from procurement and logistics, which tracks and manages inventory levels. And the second way, parts can be retrieved, is where fleet management supervisors are given access to small unstaffed stock rooms with the understanding that all removed parts must be allocated to a repair work order by completing a parts checkout sheet. If parts are not allocated to a work order, the cost will be charged to that specific stock room's overhead costs. For instance, in 2023, less than 1% were not applied to a work order. Although this is a relatively insignificant amount, the service level agreement's intention is that if parts are frequently charged to overhead at a specific stock room, An evaluation of that stockroom and supervisor should be conducted to ensure procedures are being followed and discrepancies of parts are resolved. When asked about the weaknesses in physical security around parts, division staff stated that they faced several obstacles in securing parts, including not having full authority over the stockroom, which belongs to facilities management, a division of general services. Additionally, during our on-site observations, we noted a lack of physical space required to securely store the full inventory of tires. However, division staff stated that physical access improvements are underway. For example, new batch readers have been installed at the Central Platte campus's building, shop doors, and stock rooms, which reduces the need for physical keys. Without improvements around physical security of parts and compliance with performance goals set in the service level agreement, the department risks parts going missing and their loss going undetected. Therefore, we make the following two recommendations. I will read both recommendations before pausing for questions and comments. Recommendation 3.3 on page 23 states, the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure should perform a full physical security assessment of its buildings and locations where parts are being stored and identify risk-based approaches for securing vulnerable parts. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of March 31st, 2025. Recommendation 3.4 on the same page states, the Fleet Management Division should comply with the existing and approved service level agreement related to linking performance goals to inventory management. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of March 31st, 2025. I would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the department or audit committee members.
Questions from the committee? Department, comments?
No, we agree with the recommendations. I do want to take the opportunity just to recognize the Dottie Logistics Office and manager John Carmichael. They've been a great partner to us and have been right in the hot seat with us as we try and stretch every dollar and remain really responsive to our customers, and they serve more than just the Dottie fleet. They're a great partner.
Thank you.
John? Subfinding 3, beginning on page 24, states that there are no policies and procedures to guide and document the decision-making process for outsourcing maintenance and repair work. As detailed in Table 1 on page 24, the division spent nearly $5 million between 2022 and 2023 on outsourced work for approximately 800 jobs. According to division staff, work is sometimes outsourced to keep pace with demand. In addition, various factors are considered when deciding to outsource, such as staffing levels, in-house capabilities, the number of vehicles that require repairs or maintenance, and what agreements are held with specific agencies to ensure vehicles are ready when they need them. Some repair and maintenance jobs, such as towing, windshield repairs or replacement, major engine work, and aerial inspections for trucks performing work on power lines, will always be outsourced because of the specialized nature of the work. Although management states the main reason for outsourcing is due to understaffing, and our analysis confirms that current staffing levels are not enough to keep up with the demand for services, management did not document their reasoning and have not conducted a cost-benefit analysis of this practice. Leading practices encourages the use of performing a cost-benefit analysis when outsourcing, as this helps to assess whether fleet maintenance and repair should be outsourced and which vendors to work with. This analysis should be required by division policies and procedures, and the results should be documented. Without clear guidelines for determining whether work should be outsourced, decisions may be inconsistent. And without clear guidelines, work may be outsourced for vehicles that are not being fully used or are past their useful lives, wasting taxpayer dollars. Therefore, we make the following recommendation. Recommendation 3.5 on page 25 states, the Fleet Management Division should create and document policies and procedures for determining when work should be outsourced. At a minimum, these policies and procedures should include criteria for outsourcing work, a requirement to perform a cost-benefit analysis, roles and responsibilities, and documenting the decision. The department agreed with the recommendation with the implementation date of December 31st, 2024. I would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the department or audit committee members.
Audit committee? Department?
This is a good one. I think we talked a little bit about outsourcing earlier, that in the past when we had more like a $500,000, $600,000 outsourcing budget every year and we generally met it, or it was for things that we couldn't do in-house. And then now, more recently, we've had to rely on outsourcing as an extension of our staff. And I do want to give a nod to the team who uses their discretion every day, scanning the floor, thinking about where their customers are. But this has give us an opportunity to really document that and be more disciplined in following an SOP that's really well-reasoned and written down on paper. And that's actually already in flight, so we expect to have that by the end of the year.
Thank you. Sure.
I will now continue with our fourth sub-finding of finding three. Sub-finding four, beginning on page 26, states, the city's main fleet management software, AssetWorks, present ongoing challenges. Since going live in 2021, the division faced challenges with AssetWorks, including implementing contracted functionality, such as workday integration and data reliability issues, particularly around preventative maintenance data. Data related to preventative maintenance is critical to fleet management's operations, as it includes dates of vehicle inspections, emissions testing, registration renewal, and oil changes. Because of a change in information systems used by fleet management, some preventative maintenance data became corrupted and unreliable. For example, some vehicles were listed in AssetWorks as being 8,000 days, or about 22 years, late for their scheduled preventative maintenance. Division officials said they are in the process of manually cleaning the preventative maintenance data, but without reliable data, fleet management could be using inaccurate information to schedule critical vehicle maintenance to ensure the fleet remains operational. AssetWorks was intended to be integrated into Workday, the city system of record, but this integration has not occurred nearly 3 years into the contract. Because of this delay in contracted functionality, the division is needed to devote additional resources to develop custom Power BI dashboards to track and display necessary fleet management information that could have otherwise been shown in the contracted AssetWorks functionality. Therefore, we make the following two recommendations. I will read both recommendations before pausing for questions and comments. Recommendation 3.6 on page 27 states, the Fleet Management Division should systematically review and identify any instances of inaccurate data in AssetWorks to ensure the data is reliable and can be used for informed decision making. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of March 31st, 2025. Recommendation 3.7 on the same page states, the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure should work with AssetWorks and the city's technology service agency to develop and document improvements to AssetWorks fleet management functionality as stated in their original vendor contract. The department agreed with the recommendation with an implementation date of September 30th, 2025. This concludes our presentation. We thank you for your time and would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the department or audit committee members.
Audit committee?
Well, I just like to ask a little clarification on why AssetWorks is not working. Is it that the vendor failed to implement or help you implement everything that was involved in the implementation of AssetWorks and connecting it with Workday, or was it that you didn't have the staff to complete the implementation, or something else?
Mm-hmm. Or is it just a bad product?
Yeah, is it a...
How much time do you have? I'll let Brad weigh in here too. It's a combination of a number of things, but I think probably the biggest thing that has been a challenge for us is that there were a number of things promised in the original scope that are not yet delivered. So we are working with AssetWorks on a timeline to deliver those, and a lot of those functionalities can really help us in day-to-day operations. We do only have one administrator here that is focused on making that system work as best as it can for us and coordinating with AssetWorks, and that is Bill Zola, one of our managers. But every single team member is in that system every single day. It is a very robust program, and that can be a really good thing. It can also be overcomplicated when it doesn't need to be overcomplicated. For example, there's 10,000 different task codes. So if you want to note that you changed a radiator, there might be five different ways that you can tell the system you did that. So it's very difficult to streamline that and make it usable every single day. And so that's what we've been doing over the last last few years is getting to know it and then customizing it for our purposes.
Yeah, just doing a lot of data cleanup through the integration. Some of the data required a lot of cleanup from our previous system to the new system. I think initially with the vendor, they had multiple project managers that would start project with us and then move on somewhere else, and they'd hire another project manager. So they utilized multiple, I think up to four or five project managers already to help us through the integration. On the city side, working with TS, we've got a lot better hold on that now, where they're doing continuously weekly meetings, bi-weekly meetings, doing a lot of follow-up and making sure that some of those original agreements are closed and adhered to and then being built. So on our side, the Dottie side of it, working internally with Bill, Mike, Donnie, our managers over there, cleaning up the data, cleaning up the system, being on those calls, following through with that, and then creating our own internal BI reports using the APIs from that system. We've actually cleaned up a lot of that data. But, we know that's going to be a continuous basis. It's always going to be ongoing. As the data coming out is only as good as the data going in, right? So if there's errors putting stuff in, there's errors coming out of it, and just making sure that gets cleaned up and it's used properly. So.
Technology Services has also been a great partner to us. Amber Escobedo has been a phenomenal project manager in making sure they're advocating for Dottie's needs with the vendor.
Any closing comments?
I just want to highlight the staff. With fleet management, the technicians that are there every day.
Yeah.
I don't think that folks realize that any time a snowplow is out on the street, they're in the bays. When you're in bed at midnight, they're in the bays. They're often on overtime, mandatory overtime, so they have been doing everything they can to keep the fleet running operationally, and many of them have been with us for decades. We just had a 30-year retirement a few months ago. So it is a great place to work if anyone's watching who's qualified looking for a job. But Brad's a testament. He started on the floor and is now our director. And I hope you found it a great place to work. But yeah. Do you have any other statements?
No, just, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks to your team going through the audit with us. Like Cindy said earlier, I think it was more of a partnership. We were actually excited to do this, right? And I think so excited we actually requested that private audit a year prior. We recognized some stuff within our fleet we needed to clean up and address. So I think that helps us, along with your audit, helps us to move forward in the direction we want to move in, with getting some more control, more authority, better understanding of the budget needed for vehicle replacement and what it does to your fleet when you're not adequately replacing it in time. So. And then, obviously our team, thanks for our team. Like Cindy said, all the hours they put in, being understaffed, having to work overtime. That work-life balance being altered a bit, probably even more than a bit at this point. But, the great work that our team does, make sure they get recognized for everything they do on the floor, or even in our administrative staff. So.
You have a big job. You have an important job. And thank you for what you're doing. Given the staff shortage and the data cleanup, how do you have time to do the data cleanup with the shortage of personnel that you have?
Small bites at a time. So we're working on that 25 to 50 task codes at a time, working with our supervisors, our lead technicians, and technicians on the floor. What do you guys need to see as far as our labor codes go, and what don't you need to see? And then trying to adjust those, hide those. Something to note with the asset work system, right? It's a shared system. So it's used between us, PD, and fire. And some of the settings internally to that system are global settings that affect one or the other's fleets. So working in conjunction with those other departments on what changes we need to make through the system to work specifically for us. And then they do the same thing on their side, right? So some things we can't actually just remove, get rid of, or delete because they're using it for something that benefits their purpose. So, just small chunks at a time. We are working on that with our teams. And then making those changes. So I think moving forward is documenting the changes we're making. So that's some of the stuff we're not doing, is documenting the work that we've been doing and making sure we're those that get captured so we get the credit for it.
It's also the little things that the system will actually capture for us, but we're working with all of our partner departments to make sure that they're doing pre-trips and post-trips so that issues can be caught early before they become a bigger, more expensive issue that would require more downtime. So even those little tweaks and reaching out, making everyone a fleet expert. As much as we can, as much as their expertise does.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate the partnership, and I look forward to continuing to work with the department.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Our next agenda item is the follow-up on public safety expenses with the controller's office. I thought I saw the controller here.
Will you need your phone later?
Hmm? Wow, the spotter.
So I think it was at our September meeting that the controller had presented some highlights from the 2023 annual comprehensive financial report, and there was one around the expenses at public safety that went up by, say, a third from 2022, and I don't think we got a good explanation at that point in time, and that's the purpose of having the controller and the staff here this morning. So, Bill, do you want to introduce yourself and the staff and see if you can explain it to us this time?
Sounds good. Good morning, everyone. Bill Rydell, Controller's Office.
Jessica Chandler, Director of Accounting and Financial Reporting.
Luke Morrissey, Financial Accounting Manager.
Taylor Hines, Accounting Manager.
Great, thanks. So, as Auditor O'Brien said, there was a significant increase that we showed in our presentation in the 2023 ACFR, and it was a 33% increase in Department of Safety expenses from 2022 to 2023. So we went back and we dug into it a little bit, and really the anomaly is the year 2022. It's that expenses were significantly lower in 2022, and then it sort of normalized in 2023. If you have the slide in front of you, we laid it out for the years 2019 to 2023. Sorry, I'm page two. And so really that anomaly was 2022, where the expense was down, and then it like I said, it sort of normalized in 2023. I think the other important thing to keep in mind with this is these changes in expenses are primarily driven by the pension and are the result of our reporting requirements in GASB 34. So this is coming out of our conversion when we do our government-wide statement. So when we go from governmental funds to government-wide, then we're converting everything to accrual basis. And so when we do that, the treatment of those expenditures is what's driving those significant changes you're seeing from 2021, 2022, and 2023. I'm going to turn it over to Luke Morrissey to give a little more detail on that.
So if you look back to 2019 to 2023, the liability for pension liability was in line with what the offset would be for the deferred inflows and outflows. So there wasn't a huge impact in what the pension liability was going to expenses. But the portfolio started to perform really well starting in 2020, 2021, and into 2022. And so those changes actually created an asset, so it offset the expenses. And in 2022, the expense offset was so high that it really lowered the total expenses for safety. And then back into 2023, the portfolios didn't perform as well, and now you see a normalization and not a huge change in the expense of pension liability based off of the inflows, outflows, and then the total pension liability. Yes, sir.
I'm trying to understand what happened here. You're basically saying this was the pension cost.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, my understanding, you may be wrong, is pension costs is generally normalized from year to year. You know, and yes, there's some changes in assumptions periodically, but those also get adjusted over time. So I guess I'm at a loss to understand why there would be such a large change in the pension costs. There, I mean, this just doesn't, if you take a look at how FPPA works, you despite whatever you want to criticize about PERA, it really, you know, goes back to a prior governor anyway, in terms of what happened. This is inconsistent with what, anything I've ever seen in a government pension.
Well, you're seeing in 2022, the valuation of the portfolio was so high that it reduced the total expense. And that's where that's the reason why the expense was so high.
Are you telling me that if the market does really well in a given year, and you know, markets, you actually adjust the pension cost for that particular year based on what happened in the market in that year? That means that things go bouncing up and down between years depending on how the market's doing? It doesn't, this is just inconsistent with whatever, anything I've ever seen before in terms of accounting for this kind of stuff.
And before you answer that, Lou.
I'm sorry, Lou, I'm just.
2022 was a down year in the markets. The S&P 500 was down 20%.
But these were prior, it's calculated from the prior year before that into 2022 for future portfolios.
And there's not a valuation every year, it's done every other year. So for 2023, I think this is, yeah, is that the 2021 valuation?
Yep.
It's based on the 2021. So if you look at the liability overall, that's like the third line. In 2022, we were in an asset position of $219 million. Now, after the new valuation came in, after 2 years of data, we're actually in a liability position of $300 million, close to that. And so, no, we're not recognizing. These aren't like costs going out the door, but based on like accrual basis of accounting, when you're switching from an asset to a liability, you have to recognize those changes. That's like a, you know, $500 million swing right there. And this is all based on the actuarial valuations that we don't do.
In all due respects, I was on the FPPA board for 8 years. I was on the PERA Pension Oversight Subcommittee for several years in the legislature. And there's some things, a lot of things in accounting I don't get. When it comes to the pension stuff, I like to think that I have some understanding of what's going on. And I just don't understand it. You know, it just, I've never seen any other reporting entity do this kind of thing. And I don't know. I just don't get it. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, the actual dollars that go out per year have not changed. It's just the evaluation of the portfolio for future liability that has to be accounted for currently. And with the positive change in the portfolios from 2020 to 2022, caused that to be an asset. So we're just accounting for the future change now.
Well, it would seem to me, and you're talking about the accounting rules that required you to adjust what your liability is, it would seem to me that that particular item ought to be segregated from everything else, because you just don't know what's going on because of that. Now, I understand what the rules are, but it seems to me it needs to be highlighted as it is, in to my knowledge, on the financial statements of probably every governmental entity in the United States of America. It doesn't just get lumped in like this. And I think I've got to be very candid about it. I think you're doing a real disservice by lumping it in. I think a disservice to the mayor, to the city council, and to whoever reads those financial statements.
I think we're following our guidance.
And I do think it's called out. I don't know exactly what page it's on, but as you go from fund statements into government-wide statements, there's a reconciliation that calls these numbers out, correct? So it is called out in the big book that's very confusing and hard to read, right? But it's there. It's there, and it's based on the guidance that we're given in producing the act.
Was this, just out of curiosity, we had BDO as the auditors for 3 years and they're no longer the auditors going forward. Was this something that they asked you to handle that way that had not been asked of you by Forvis prior?
We've been handling this the same way since Forvis, who audited us, and with BDO, who audited us, and they were all provided the reconciliation that flows into the financial statement. So it's also been audited by both of them, yes.
And Forvis provides the templates that we use to
yes,
do all of
this. Did actually provide
they
the
did.
Like years
yeah,
ago.
But I'm talking about the reporting.
Oh. There's nothing that's been changed.
I see.
It's GASB 34.
Correct.
Yes,
right.
Okay. Any other questions? I have to tell you, I don't quite understand it, but I'll keep trying.
I would say a lot of the things that we're asked to do from a reporting perspective is very confusing, and it gets worse, right? 87, 96, there's other things that are coming that's, it does. I mean, I agree with you. It's, you know, it's confusing. It's very confusing maybe to the average reader that's not used to seeing things this way, but yeah, it's the guidance in which we have to follow. So maybe CLA can provide another perspective.
Well, I think it's a reporting issue. In other words, you have a choice with breaking some things down and how they're presented. There's no question you have to account for it.
Sure.
I mean, there's
absolutely.
I mean, but there are people who use this and are trying to evaluate how the city is operating, et cetera. And if the users have no idea of what's coming out of there, nobody can be helpful.
We did show that there was an increase in expense from prior year in the financials for safety.
No, I know that, but the point being, one thing is an adjustment. One thing is the cost, and that adjustment is going to go like this. But if you don't deal with, if you don't highlight what that accounting adjustment is so people can understand it, there's no way to judge the rest of it.
And I think we're thinking that it is highlighted in the AFRA based on the reconciliations between the fund statements and the government-wide statements. Again, not saying it's
okay.
So we don't disagree with you. We're following what we believe to be the guidance, but that's definitely something that we can look into as we're getting ready to prepare the 2024 report.
Okay.
Or if there's another way to highlight it.
Enough for me.
Will we be getting hard copies of
We just got them in.
We just got them in.
I'll have them come down to your office.
Okay.
Thank you.
The same number of copies that you normally request, about 10.
Yep.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well,
you can get to reading.
We'll up with those. All right. Well, thank you. We'll probably have another discussion like this when the market swings the other way.
Yes.
Like it will. Sure, it will. Well, it's up this year, huh?
That's true.
All right. Under general business, we'll have another meeting of this committee on November 21st at 9 o'clock here in the Par Widener room. With that, I'd like to adjourn into executive session to talk about some confidential audit topics.
So moved.
Second. Is there a second?
Second.
But any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. We're in executive session.
not in 2025. And so this is something that I'm happy in our upcoming safety committee briefing to share the exact numbers of units that we've leased up in this way. But it's been tremendously successful and will be a tool we continue to rely upon heavily.
One more thing, Madam Chair, I think you know and Council President knows, is this was a strategy we piloted during our migrant housing support resolution efforts in November and December. We actually had a couple of very innovative Department of Human Services staff members who started doing this, and then we brought on this partner to help us source units, and it was what led to our great success in housing the folks that were at the Zunai encampment. And then we took that strategy and expanded it to focus on this because they were able to find units much faster, get applications done faster, get payments processed faster instead of us having to manage all those internally. So that was a pilot strategy we used.
Just to add one thing, and I talked a little bit about this earlier, but when we are trying to rehouse people experiencing homelessness, oftentimes there's so many barriers they have in their background. And if we were trying to do this, we would have to negotiate with every landlord on every unit to waive some of those barriers. Housing Connector, they do that as part of their negotiations, is they actually have on their platform units that will accept different criteria so that we can actually house people, because that is one of the